Hello, everybody. I hope you can hear me. My name is Michael Waldman. I am the president of the Brennan Center for Justice here at NYU School of Law. We are thrilled to have you here for the first event of our series of events that we are going to be hosting and convening this fall and into the school year. As many of you know, the Brennan Center is about two decades old now. It's a nonpartisan law and policy institute affiliated with NYU, part of the tremendous intellectual life of this wonderful institution, and named after the great late Supreme Court Justice William Brennan, dedicated to him as a living memorial when he left the bench, founded actually by his family and clerks. The Brennan Center, as we have always said, works to reform and revitalize and, when necessary, protect the institutions of American democracy and justice, the systems by which we govern ourselves, the systems by which we protect our freedoms and bring our country together. And it is without a doubt that as we gather here today on September 11th, just a few miles from where the tragedy occurred in 2001, at a moment of great strain and stress for the institutions of American democracy, that effort for all of us to think and act on behalf of liberal democracy and constitutional governance here at home has never been stronger, has never been more vital. We know that those institutions are stretched taut in ways they have not been in a long time. We know also that there are many factors at play, and we're going to be discussing some, as I'll tell you in just a second, in this really remarkable and exciting conversation. But I also want to tell you about the other things the Brennan Center has planned that we hope you will be part of. As I say, this is the beginning of a new ramped-up public events series. There's a thirst right now for real conversation in person and through all the other means of communications that we have about what's going on in the country, what's going on in the world, and the links among them. This Thursday at lunchtime, we will be hosting a conversation over at the law school on Latino leadership in the age of Trump with some of the top leaders of Latino legal organizations from around the country talking about what's going on and what they want to try to do. We have events ranging from Danielle Allen from Harvard, Harvard ethics and philosophy professor, and you should, by the way, if you do not have it, take a look at this tremendous lineup. We have an event on October 18th with John Dean and Elizabeth Holtzman talking about the lessons of Watergate for this moment. Can't imagine why. And for the younger people here, we'll explain who they are and what Watergate was. But it's actually a vital and an exciting topic. And on November 8th, the first anniversary of the election of the president, we will be having an important conversation, not looking back, not pulling hair, not rending garments, but asking, what kinds of reforms, what kinds of institutional changes make sense going forward to restore the unwritten norms, to restore checks and balances, to make sure that constitutional governance goes forward in a good way. It's going to be moderated by George Stephanopoulos of ABC News. One of the speakers will be Preet Bharara, the former U.S. attorney here, and we're lining up others, and it is it's a wonderful event. All of these events are on the Brennan Center website. These are all live streamed through Facebook and other means. These will all be made public to a much wider audience than here in this room today through our electronic newsletters, through our Facebook feed, through all the other ways. And we are eager to have you all part of it, or eager to have you sign up if you haven't signed up already. We do ask that you turn off your cell phones. Not a Broadway show, but we are going to be taping this and making it, using it in a whole bunch of different ways. And you should know also that we're delighted in particular to have this event today. Technology, globalization, digitization, all the things that have shake and remake our world have obviously shaken our politics as well and shaken our institutions of government. And just as at every other time of history where there's been a technological change, where there's been an economic change, public institutions need, at the very least, to catch up. It's certainly the case, for example, in this country that the progressive era of the early 20th century was, if nothing else, a response to technological change and efforts then to modernize their governmental and democratic institutions for that new time. It's plainly the case that technology has affected our world and, in particular, for our focus, affected our democracy, our sense of privacy, our sense of freedom, the constitutional guarantees we hold dear. And we are really, really thrilled to have to speak to us about this and in conversation with one of my Brennan Center colleagues, Daniel Franklin. He is the executive editor of The Economist, which we all know is a brilliant publication for all of us who want to understand with real facts, real analysis, what's going on. His book, Megatech, which he's edited, is on so many of these topics, and it is for sale outside. And we encourage you to take a look, and we will be hearing about that, and I want to introduce him and my colleague, Faiza Patel. Faiza is the co-director of our Liberty and National Security Program, works on so many of these issues day in and day out, and look forward to hearing the conversation and hearing about the topic. So thank you so much for being here.
So good afternoon, everybody. I hope everyone had a chance to grab something to eat and are well settled in for what's going to be an interesting conversation, I'm sure. This is, as Michael said, the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School's initial event for the fall for our public lineup. We are, like everybody else, on Facebook and on Twitter, and you should definitely check out our website, BrennanCenter.org, because we have a great deal of interesting content across a range of issues, including podcasts and videos and things like that. We're also on iTunes and YouTube, so you basically can't get away from us if you're plugged in. My name is Faiza Patel. I'm the co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program, and I'm going to be moderating your program today. So technology, in fact, megatech, as this book says, is obviously all around us. We see it. You know, things that took us hours take us minutes. People can work together from Boston to Bangladesh. It facilitates organizing. It facilitates protests. I don't know if the Women's March that took place earlier this year would have been possible without social media. The same goes for the Arab Spring. So many other pro-democratic things have been facilitated by technology. At the same time, right, we're all slightly dislocated by technology, and we're a little bit afraid of it. You know, companies collect more and more of our data, but can they and do they keep it safe? Just a few days ago, we saw the Equifax stories on the front page of the Times. You know, that's not the first hack. It's not going to be the last hack. How do we protect our data and our information in this world? You know, algorithms, which this book talks about a great deal, are used to predict and to make a lot of decisions about our lives, whether it's your credit rating or whether you get a mortgage. Companies are using them to screen employees for ideal profiles. They really shape the way our futures are going to play out, whether it's students or consumers or just, you know, members of civil society. But, you know, what do we really know about how these algorithms operate and whether or not they're fair and whether what they're doing is the right thing, however you might define that? And, of course, the big issue of, you know, if robots are going to do our jobs, what on earth are we all going to do for the next century is something I think that's very much in people's minds. My guest today, Daniel Franklin, has this new book, Megatech, Technology in 2050, which explores the frontiers of technology and really, I think, highlights the need for us to deal with these issues and to deal with them now rather than later when these waves of technology have already washed over us and it may well be too late. As the executive editor of The Economist, Daniel has long experience in grappling with a range of complex issues. And he really, I think, by editing this book and having kind of curated this selection of leading scientists and thinkers, given us a window into what the world might look like and what challenges we might face. And so we're really excited to have you here today. I'm glad you're in New York so that we can talk about these issues in person. Welcome, Daniel, to the Brennan Center. So let me start with my first question. So one of the themes of this book is that technology is changing at an incredibly rapid pace, right? That what's happening is an acceleration in part brought on by developments in physics and our ability to test things without actually testing them. Given that, isn't it audacious, and some might even say a little bit crazy, to think about predicting what technology will be like in 2050?
Well, thanks very much, Faiz, and thank you for having me here. It's an honor to be here, and rather special to be here on September the 11th in particular. Yes, in a certain level, you're absolutely right. It is crazy to if the exercise is to say exactly what is the world going to be like in 2050. Of course, we can't know that. But I think there is value in a couple of things, which is what motivated me to put this book together. The first is the value in taking, as it were, the long view, to lift one's eyes above the immediate horizon. I spend a lot of my time at The Economist working on a year-ahead horizon. I edit something called mm-hmm. The World, whatever the next year is. So The World in 2018 is the one that I'm currently working on, and that's fascinating. But sometimes if you go even further and say what's going to be happening in a decade or 2 decades or 3 decades, you sometimes have a better sense of the change in tectonic plates and you see the bigger picture. So I think there's a virtue in that. And then the second thing, which is very much what I attempted to do in this book, is not to say exactly how are things going to be, which you can't do, but what are some of the things we need to think about in preparing ourselves for that world. So perhaps I should say just a little bit about how this book is put together. As you said, it's a collection of 20 contributors, and the first part of the book is what I call explore some of the fundamental drivers of technology. You mentioned physics, and that's a very good one. So, what is it about the state of physics today that can have an impact on the way technology develops over the coming decades? And sure enough, yes. Frank Wilczek, who is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, writes a very brilliant analysis of saying that we can do a lot more now by calculation rather than experimentation, and that just by itself allows change and developments to happen much faster. Similar conclusion from an exploration of where we are in biology with exponential change in the efficiency and reduction in the cost of DNA sequencing and what that's unlocking. And the very first chapter in the book is by my colleague Tom Standage, who says, here's a toolkit I use for looking at the future, and perhaps just mention that briefly, which is three things can really help you. History can be a useful light on the future. Tom wrote a whole book on what he called the Victorian Internet, which was, of course, the electric telegraph. And that the way that developed has a lot of parallels with the way that the Internet itself developed. So it pays to look at that historical example. A good sort of analogy today would be driverless cars. So a natural place to look would be the history of how did we move from horse-drawn carriages to horse-less carriages, i.e. the motor car that we've now known for 100 years or more. And again, that people were worried about a lot of the things that we're worried about today when we talk about driverless cars. You know, what about all the people who are employed in this industry? What would happen to them? What about the regulation for these new things that drive them, that are powered by internal combustion engine? What about the infrastructure that you need for them to work, all the gas stations and so on? Very much similar. What about the town planning? Very much the same sorts of things we're grappling with trying to think through driverless cars. So history is one thing. The next part of his toolkit is what he calls edge cases from the present. So this is essentially trend spotting, and there's this famous quotation that from William Gibson, that the future is already here, it's just not very evenly distributed. So technology tends not to arrive fully formed overnight from one day to the next. If you know where to look, you can see tomorrow's technology today. But the trick is knowing where to look. And so if you're smart, you can start to spot tomorrow's trend. I'll just give one example. My favorite example of that is mobile phones in Japan. The Japanese had a rather insular development of their mobile telephone system. So they started doing things that were not being done elsewhere earlier than were being done elsewhere. And the mobile phone, they started much earlier than we did in Europe or you did in America, having all sorts of uses for the phone. And the ones who were particularly enthusiastic early users of this were young Japanese girls. So I think it was Wired magazine actually started a column called Japanese Schoolgirl Watch, with the idea being that what Japanese schoolgirls were doing today, the rest of us would be doing tomorrow. So it was a good way of seeing early use of technology. So if you can do the equivalent of that, if you can spot the sort of smart, and you often find it in rather strange places, and it's obviously it's very hard to know where the right place to look is, but it certainly pays the effort. So that was the second tool in his toolkit. The third is actually science fiction, because science fiction often sort of explores to the nth degree the consequences of technology and where it can lead. So artificial intelligence is all these algorithms. Very good example of that. You'll find in films now and in sci-fi books the sort of how this could all go wrong, or in some cases how it could go right, but usually you find how it can go wrong. And that's really helpful to think that through. What happens when the machines take over? What sort of governance would you have under a machine-run world? Thinking the science fiction writers can think that through more than you can if you're just got your eyes focused on the present. And it turns out that a lot of technologists are actually sci-fi fans, so they often look at the film or look at the book and then try to recreate that in real life. I think Elon Musk is one example, and I met someone in Japan just recently who had been very inspired by Isaac Asimov, and he's a technology entrepreneur himself. So that's the toolkit, and that's a little bit the toolkit that I use in the book. We look at historical examples, we look sector by sector for edge cases from the present, and there's also even a couple of science fiction contributions. The two penultimate, two of the last chapters are actually by science fiction writers, one American, one Scottish. And in a certain sense, they're almost the most real feeling chapters in the book, even though they're fiction, because they explore the moral dimensions and the very human dimensions of the technology.
So one of the things that I thought was really interesting about this book is that it actually explores developments in technology across a range of sectors, right? So usually you'll see a book that talks about one thing or the other, and what was nice was this sort of broad overview. If you were to pick one area that you thought was going to be the most beneficial to human beings across all of the things that you've looked at in this book, what would you pick?
Gosh, that's a part of the problem is that when you think what are the beneficial things, it's also this is very two-edged, because there's usually another aspect to it. But I would say very broadly two things. One is the technology that will help feed a world of probably, you know, between 9 and 10 billion people by 2050. So that's probably the most basic thing. You know, how does humanity keep itself going when there are so many more people on the planet? And technology is going to be a huge help in that. And the fascinating chapter on farming looks at, I suppose, two aspects of that. One is much more efficient current methods of farming, the sort of stuff that you would recognize today, but turbocharged by things like big data. So you know almost down to the inch what the most efficient use of a particular bit of soil is, and you can zap bugs with the help of very targeted drones and that kind of thing. But also new types of farming where you have meat that is produced from cell cultures rather than from live animals, for example. Or you have vertical farms. Forget the farmer in the field with the Wellington boots. You know, you have indoor farming with no natural light, all artificial, no soil, just hydroponic production. Fruit, vegetables being produced very close to where most of us will be living, which is in cities. So those are quite sort of exciting visions, I think. So I think feeding ourselves is one thing, and then health, to take the other very human thing. I think enormous advances are going to be made in, for example, the battle against cancer, tackling some very, very damaging diseases. Alzheimer's, I'm sure, over this horizon will make great progress in. But again, there's dark side here, because you know, the testing of DNA and the insights that gives into what all of us are likely to develop over our lifetimes, and what you do with those data, that has big social and indeed no doubt legal implications as well.
So data, right? I mean, a lot of this book is about data and how we're going to use data. One thing that sort of strikes me as a human being is, how are we as human beings going to be able to cope with so much data? You know, when I'm driving, I can barely keep up with the GPS and the phone and the music playing. That's like enough for my little brain to handle. I mean, if I'm a soldier, which is one of the examples, you know, out in the field, and all of this information is being beamed to me about all of the targets who are in front of me and who they are and what they mean, all of that, are we going to be able to process all of that?
Well, I guess there'll be data algorithms that will help to find the maximum amount, the optimal amount of data that you can cope with. And this is not a new problem. I mean, if you're an airline pilot and you think of the dashboard, you know, you've got masses of stuff coming at you, but obviously you don't want, the last thing you want there is overload. You want it to be absorbable. And same thing when you're, as you say, when you're driving a car. So there's clearly a danger of overload of data individually and also for society, and you can have there's an issue obviously of the quality of the data as well. But the successful applications of the data will be precisely the ones that integrated into a way that is very instantly usable and enables you precisely to cope with all that information in a way that you can process. So, you know, I suppose an obvious example is an internet search engine, where you've got enormous amounts of data being trawled through at incredible speed, but then coming back with amazing frequency with a result that is absolutely useful for you and that helps you get at something, as you say, much faster than you could ever have dreamt of doing in the past.
So we've talked a little bit generally about the book and sort of the vision that it presents for the future. And I was hoping we could spend a little time delving into some of the issues that I work at the Brennan Center. I have to say, the freakiest thing for me is this idea that human beings are going to be sort of directly wired into the internet. right? I mean, that has to be by far the creepiest part of this idea. But what that implies, of course, as the book explores, is that in order to take advantage of something like that, in order to have all this data come at us and to be able to fully utilize it, we're also going to have to give up pretty much all of our data and our privacy as well. And the thing that strikes me is that, you know, I look at the law and technology now, and we're still struggling to figure out what the right rule should be for your tracking information that's on your iPhone. And I find it really difficult to imagine how we could possibly get ready in 30-plus years for a scenario in which our brains are wired to the Internet.
Yeah, well, I think that is a huge challenge. I think you're absolutely right. But it's not going to go away by saying how, you know, we can't possibly do it. I think there is an absolute leitmotif of the book, and this is not something that I ask people, these contributors, who, by the way, are about sort of half of them are colleagues from The Economist and half are people I invited from outside. A leitmotif is this struggle that regulators are going to cope with the pace of technological change, and you see that in area after area. The technology is going to be moving faster than... they're going to be playing catch-up with what's happening. And you see this absolutely in sort of the data privacy conversation that happens now. And often also the response to it is not the same in different parts of the world, and even in liberal democracies. You know, the American response is and level of regulation is often different from the European response and level of regulation, let alone what happens in you know, less free societies like China. So I think you're completely right that I mentioned medical records. I think it's absolutely the case with the potential plugging in of ourselves to the internet. But it sounds fantasy, but you know, serious money is now going into research for this. And again, I mentioned Elon Musk. He's one of the people who's investing in this. So regulators are going to find themselves having to make rules for this. They're going to have to find themselves making rules for human enhancements of various sorts, whether it's us connected to machines or us editing DNA to change our babies, you know, and improve our children's capabilities. Anybody who thinks that isn't going to happen or there isn't going to be pressure for people to do that hasn't focused on the multi-gazillion dollar cosmetics and human enhancement industry that is out there already. You know, we spend a fortune. We use the technology that is available with enormous enthusiasm to try to make ourselves better, and we're going to do that with all tools available. So governments have to get wise to the regulatory challenges ahead, and they are. I think it's a fact of life. They're going to be playing catch up.
Well, one thing that actually prevents governments from regulating in these industries is that there's a lot of resistance from the industries as well. So you mentioned, you know, data privacy. In the United States, we don't have any broad data privacy framework, any, you know, sort of fundamental regulations relating to, you know, what data is, who owns it, what the companies can do with it, what our rights are vis-a-vis data. And in Europe, of course, they've had much stronger data privacy protections. But one of the reasons we don't have it here is that every major company that's involved in this says, no, 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 we're going to deal with it ourselves. So how do we sort of deal with this sort of tradition of industry self-regulation in a way? Voluntary codes are very popular, for example, in the United States, and this resistance to government regulation. So what is the role of corporations versus vis-a-vis governments, I guess?
Well, obviously, corporations and governments, there's going to be a to-ing and fro-ing between them, inevitably, and there's a role of individuals as well at a mobilization or organization level, and also at a, you know, the sum total of individual decisions if you have a choice as to whether to make data available or not. You know, what do individuals choose to do? And there are trade-offs here. I think that's the complex reality, that it's not a simple question of saying this is good or bad. There are good and bad ways of doing things. There are there's balances of choices, because data, you know, we had on our cover at The Economist this week facial recognition technology, which plays right into these themes, and this is very much coming now. These companies are starting to, and governments are starting to use this technology. It's going to get more and more sophisticated, and it's going to throw up regulatory challenges, and it will produce great conveniences and great advantages. And I think Apple's new phone, they say probably it's going to be facial recognition security, which will be very convenient. But where does it all lead, and are we comfortable with that, and will we decide as individuals, yes, I'm happy to give up my data in order to have that convenience? Those are very, very real trade-offs. Often, and perhaps to a surprising extent, people do seem prepared to say, okay, I will give up my data because I want the convenience of the service that giving it up, you know, we're prepared to switch on our mobile roaming so that the whatever company can track us and provide the service, we're prepared to let companies sort of have our data so that we can get things free. But there may be a generational aspect of this, that younger people who are used to the technology are more prepared to make this trade-off than older people who are more suspicious of a surveillance society. I don't know, but it's definitely a trade-off, and that trade-off is that where you draw the line, as you say, is often done differently in different places. And we're about to have a whole swathe of European data regulation come in, which is much tighter than you have in the United States. And that itself actually creates problems for companies that are trying to navigate or trade across different jurisdictions.
So I want to push back a little bit on this idea that there are these individual decisions, right? Because, I mean, I don't know, has anyone here sort of read the terms of service of Yahoo or Gmail or whichever, whatever you use for email, right? I don't think anybody really does that, right? So that's one part of the regulatory framework. They're like, well, yeah, you know, we told you that, you know, we were basically going to monitor everything you did on our service, so you have nothing to complain about. Similarly, I'm not sure that people realize the extent to which their data is a commodity. I mean, yes, within a certain part of society they do, but I'm not sure that more broadly people do realize that, and certainly not when you get outside of the developed world. A lot of times people have no choice, right? You know, I work for the Brennan Center, they give me a phone, they're like, off you go, we need to be able to reach you. No, I mean, these are not individual decisions made in the sort of knowing, conscious, we're giving up something over here. So given that they're may not be full agency in that, and yet you have corporations who are accumulating already vast amounts of data. You have governments, at least in the United States, which is not willing or not capable of regulating that. How does that balance get worked out?
This is all true, and you have to be either mad or heroic to read the full terms and conditions. You could regulate that to some extent and say this has to be very clear, clearly stated, and clear opt-ins and opt-outs. But often, you know, opting out is quite a bold thing to do and may involve some sacrifice of career, or you might be considered just not in the conversation, and you might miss out on an awful lot. So it's very hard decision to take. But I think there are pressures that individuals can bring to bear, and obviously more so when they group together as pressure groups and can start to influence a pushback if if companies are behaving in ways that are ultimately damaging, or indeed if they feel that the balance is wrong and needs to be redressed. And I think that part of the proof of that is that it does work differently in different societies. In Germany, for example, where people are particularly concerned for historical reasons about data privacy, there's a different balance struck politically than there has been here. So it just shows that the democratic process can work differently, partly because of public opinion and public pressure on politicians.
What impact do you think Snowden has had on the debate around data privacy?
Well, it's made people think about it, first of all. So I think it's made people much more aware of the degree of what's collected, what's the way that the government is, where the tentacles go, and the potential the scale of all that. At the same time, even there, I think there are trade-offs that people are increasingly aware of. Here we are on 9/11. People also demand that our security services stop plots before they're hatched, are aware of what's going on. So there's a very real and legitimate demand for ways that we can reach into people who are trying to harm us and stop them doing nasty stuff, and there is a trade-off to happen there. So again, there's no simple answer to this stuff. You want to preserve the maximum amount of freedom at all levels, including the freedom from being blown up.
So we're 30 minutes into the program, and I just wanted to remind people that this is the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School, and we're talking to Daniel Franklin, the executive editor of The Economist and the author of a new book called Megatech, Technology in 2050. And I'm Faiza Patel, your moderator. Coming back to the conversation, I just want to ask you one more sort of longish question, and then maybe we can do a lightning round where I'm going to throw random words at you and see how you react. So people have this sort of belief that if the computer does it, it's got to be right. And the computer doesn't have
not
human
my
biases.
Computer.
but in fact, you know, what we've seen is that algorithms are not always right. Facebook very famously, I guess it was about a year ago now, took down an iconic Vietnam War photo because it had a young girl who was naked under its nudity rules. Algorithms are also criticized for replicating inequities in society, and the thing that I think about is, you know, predictive policing is this like shiny new toy that a lot of people are running after, but in fact when you look at the data that goes into predictive policing algorithms, it's often racially biased markers such as arrest rates, which we know are much higher for Black and Latino populations. So I just sort of wonder about this idea that the algorithm is going to be right. We're not going to know what's in the algorithm. These are sort of some of the challenges that we need to be dealing with. And do you have any thoughts about how, like maybe some principles perhaps as to how we might deal with algorithmic decision making?
Yes, well, I think you're very right to highlight the issue, and clearly if you get bad data in, you're going to get very bad decisions out, and the way that the algorithm works could be dumb. With technology, you always have to be, and actually this is the last chapter in the book, is an exploration of unintended consequences of technology. And with the best will in the world, and you can think you're creating the most beautiful algorithm, there could be unintended consequences, possibly social consequences, possibly in another area. So I think the first thing is a healthy skepticism of what you were implying, that the computer is always right. You know, skepticism that there could be, you know, what's wrong here? What's the problem here? Look on it. Don't look at it as something that is necessarily infallible. This whole issue that you mentioned of racially biased data is something that's discussed again in the context of the facial recognition piece that we have in The Economist this week, that actually the data there is primarily gathered for white people and other ethnicities. It may not be nearly as reliable, or may produce peculiar results. So you have to be very careful of that. So another principle you might apply is that this sort of thing should be submitted to independent audit from time to time. Much as you submit your accounts to audit, submit the algorithms to audit, you could imagine that there would be services cropping up in the same way that you have accounting services or government auditors to say, is this, you would need to get some sort of assessment as to the reliability of the algorithms and the data that's going into it. So I think all those sorts of precautions, and then there's the whole area of whether or not the boxes should be
right,
opened up, or whether it's hidden. And one of the worries about the rapid, very rapid development, we've talked mainly about democracies here, and thankfully in democracies we can raise the very real possibility of this sort of scrutiny, but perhaps a bigger worry is what happens in these sorts of domains in societies that don't have that degree of scrutiny. China is going to be very, very competitive in artificial intelligence, and the pressure to sort of open up the boxes there is perhaps not nearly as intense as it is in vigorous democracies like this one.
So really, very interesting questions that I guess we'll be pondering for the next 30 years at least. So I'm going to throw out a couple of words and sort of get your responses to them to just move things along a bit. Genetically modified food.
Generally, I think, again, you have to be careful, you have to test and so on, but genetic, most food that we eat is in some sense genetically modified, and over the course of many, many years, that's the way it's developed. We're not eating the food that our distant ancestors ate. And genetic manipulation of crops to get higher yields is going to be a very important part of feeding a world of 10 billion people. So I think with proper regulation, obviously, that is an area where we should be welcoming progress properly regulated.
Okay. Killer robots?
killer robots, it's something they're going to come because, in fact, they're already here to some extent. I mean, we're already sending up drones into the sky, which are, in fact, killer robots, and you could certainly say that it's better, at least, for countries not to be sending their people up to die in those machines, and better to have robots doing the fighting than humans. But you obviously, I think, have to be careful that the robots don't remain ultimately have a responsibility, someone who is held accountable for the robots. And I think the rules of warfare, it's something that's very live debate at the moment, are going to be something that we have to pay much more attention to, because the capabilities of the killer robots are going to be growing very rapidly.
Fake news?
My microphone was almost cut off there by fake news.
That was me.
yes, well, one of the things that distresses me about all the discussion around fake news is that the very term fake news is being debased. Fake news in some contexts now is actually just another word, or what is branded as another word for the truth. So news you don't like in certain contexts is branded as fake, but it's only because they don't like it, and often it's true. So obviously when news is genuinely fake, and I understand to be fake news stuff that is fabricated, is a terrible thing, and what you need to combat it is real news. And so I'm against fake news, but I'm even more against the misuse of the term fake news.
What's going to be the Netflix of the future?
Everybody wants to be Netflix, by the way. I mean, that's going to be, and this is not 2050, this is streaming of content is there's going to be that's the next technology, imminent technology battle. You know, Disney is getting into that, and Netflix has really shaken up the way that people consume what used to be called television, I suppose, and as we have to call it something else. There's a lot of talk, and this is, I think, going to be interesting to see how this plays out, of virtual reality and augmented reality. So will that be the next level of the immersive experience of watching screens? I'm yet to be persuaded that the technology has to make a few more leaps to make this really something that's easy for consumers to do, to experience. At the moment, you still have to put on rather cumbersome kit, but when that day arrives, when it's really simple, then I expect that something to do with virtual reality will be the next phase of Netflix, and it'll be a much more sort of immersive and customizable experience, I guess.
So last one, venture capital.
Well, a very big, important thing for the technology industry. One of the contributions is from a tech venture capitalist, Anne Wimblatt from Silicon Valley. She's been a great sort of pioneer in the software area. And she interestingly says that it's another of the sort of long-term techniques for looking into the future of technology is to follow the money. Where is the money going? She has this great analogy of technology being like waves, whereby as the wave forms out in the ocean, there are lots and lots of companies out there where you get money is being invested in them. But as they come closer to shore, only a few survive, and it takes a long time for them to come in, typically sort of 10 years or so. And by the time they hit the shore, each wave has brought in only a handful of companies that then become the giants that we know. And she says that the current wave of investment is in AI, artificial intelligence, also quite a lot in quantum computing. And we're about 4 years into that wave. So if history is a guide, we'd expect that in sometime middle of next century, next decade, far too long time horizon, middle of the 2020s, we will get some very giant AI type and quantum computing companies that will be starting to make a really big impact on our world.
So I think we can all join together to thank you for really an excellent and thought-provoking. And I can remind you all that if you're interested in buying a copy of this fabulous book, which I highly recommend, you can do so outside. Thank you.